From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the second of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled In the Talmud, The Greatness of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University Department of Religion Chair Diana Klepper.
Tonight, Professor Wiesel turns his attention to one of the most compelling and complicated figures in the Talmud, Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, or Eliezer the Great, a man who also saw difficult times and rescued treasures of the past to present to the future. Eliezer was one of the disciples who helped to smuggle the great scholar Yochanan ben Zakkai out of Jerusalem during the Roman siege. Yochanan went on to establish the community of scholars at Yavna, a move credited by tradition with allowing for the formation of Judaism as we know it after the destruction of the temple. For his part, Eliezer went on to found a school in Lida, marry Ima Shalom, the sister of Rabban Gamliel, and become the teacher of the great Rabbi Akiva. He remained beloved by tradition in spite of suffering excommunication by his colleagues for failure to bend to the majority. Eliezer helped to preserve the past and so helped to guarantee the future. Elie Wiesel, too, is a preserver of the past. But the past is not brought into the present for the past's sake. If you have been moved by night, if you are inspired by the memory and the humanity Professor Wiesel represents, you must also take the gift he offers us through his storytelling. Even a man who needs no introduction still merits one. To the well-known facts that he was born in Transylvania, that he survived the horrors of Auschwitz and Buchenwald and went on to become a journalist and book author, to devote his life to humanitarian concerns, that his work has been acknowledged with many honors, including the Nobel Peace Prize. To this I would add, Elie Wiesel really is the kind, gentle, and soulful human being you imagine him to be. Since 1976, he has been the Andrew W. Mellon Professor in the Humanities here, serving as a member of the faculty in the Department of Religion and Philosophy. He lectures on Job in the core curriculum every year. He has taught hundreds of students in his Literature of Memory classes, and he must have spoken to tens of thousands in the Encounter series by now. I am incredibly honored to count him as my colleague here at BU. Please join me in welcoming Eliezer Wiesel as he takes the stage to talk about his long ago namesake.
First of all, thank you very much. Thank you for linking the two Eliezers in one breath. I wish I were as courageous, as audacious as he was. But nevertheless, I must tell you right away, just as I said last week about Isaac, I happen to like Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. I like him because of his solitude. I like him because of his tragic end. I like him because he was who he was. Never tried to please. Never tried to surrender. He remained with his ideas. He remained faithful to his ideas to the very end. No matter what others said, he was ready to be alone. And to be alone is not always easy. It wasn't easy for him. Traditionally, our second annual lecture always deals with the Talmud. It's a tradition, and we are not going to break it, of course. His, Rabbi Eliezer's, intellectual riches and psychological depth is a subject for us to study, to explore, and try to find meaning that is behind the meaning. I am exaggerating, perhaps, when I declare my profound belief that study kept Judaism alive throughout centuries in exile. And therefore, we chose tonight to speak about a Talmudic figure, one of the greatest, and by the name they called him, Rabbi Eliezer the Great, Hagadol. We know that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the pillar of Talmudic learning and the creation of the yeshivot, that he had five disciples. The first is Rabbi Eliezer, and he is described like a cemented cistern that does not lose a drop. If all the sages of Israel were placed on one pan of the balance scale, and Rabbi Eliezer on the other, said Rabbi Yochanan, he would outweigh them all. Did he know that? Has he heard Rabbi Yochanan's praise? Was he affected by it later? Is this why at one point he found himself the audacity to oppose all his colleagues, leading to his banishment? Is memory so important in the Talmud? They called him the great only because he had such a great memory. Is Rabbi Eliezer great only because he remembered everything? I spoke about him actually here 30 years ago, if not more. But I go on studying him. In the beginning, I spoke about him because I had to find a great sage in the Talmud of whom I could speak with fervor. But now I have reread everything by him and about him. And now I know why I like him so much. I do like him. Now, was it a dream in his life? A certain Rabbi Hananel believes it was a dream. Legend has it that on that particular day, in the celebrated Academy of Yavne, the debate centered around the question whether an oven named by a certain Achnai was to be considered ritually pure or not. The oven was of a special kind, built in a special way, and Rabbi Eliezer saw no reason not to consider it pure, whereas all the other sages invoked many reasons to treat it as impure. Though alone, Rabbi Eliezer fought for his ideas and brought forth all the most extraordinary arguments in the world. But his colleagues rejected them all. When his rational arguments failed, he naturally turned to the supernatural and exclaimed, "If the law agrees with me, may this carob tree prove it." Whereupon the carob tree was torn out by its roots and blown a distance of 100 or 1,000 cubits. But the sages were unimpressed. "A carob tree is no proof," they said. "All right," said Rabbi Eliezer, "if the law is as I see it, may this nearby stream of water prove it." Thereupon a stream of water turned and flowed backwards. Still unimpressed, the sages commented, "A stream of water proves nothing." At this point, Rabbi Eliezer could not repress his annoyance. "If this law is the way I interpret it," he said, "let the walls of this house of study prove it." And so they did. They began to topple. "What are you doing?" scolded the old Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanania. "If scholars are debating a question of law, what business is it of yours?" Embarrassed, the walls did not fall down out of respect for Rabbi Yoshua, but they did not straighten up out of respect for Rabbi Eliezer. But then Rabbi Eliezer had reached the limits of his patience, and you can almost hear him cry out in exasperation, "If the law is according to my interpretation, let heaven prove it." And heaven did. A voice was heard. "Why do you torment Rabbi Eliezer? Why do you make his life miserable? Don't you know that he is always right?" Whereupon Rabbi Yoshua rose to his feet and on behalf of his colleagues, told the celestial intruder not to interfere. And he said, "The Torah is not in heaven. It was given once and for all at Sinai, and now it belongs to man, and we do not listen to voices from heaven. Moreover, the Torah tells us, Achrei Rabim Lehatot, we are duty-bound to abide by the rule of the majority, and that must have been and was the end of the discussion." But the next move was a practical one, one which I deplore with all my heart. At the end of the discussion, all the legal opinions related to purification matters issued in the name of Rabbi Eliezer were declared invalid and thrown into the fire. Then there followed a vote to excommunicate Rabbi Eliezer. Let's stop here and examine the story so far. What do we learn from it? In truth, there is something disturbing in the story. Isn't the Talmud based on dialogue? Isn't that which makes it so glorious and transcending time and frontier and passion? Which means, isn't the Talmud a celebration of the right to be different, to demonstrate the beauty of discussion and dissension? Why then should the great Rabbi Eliezer be punished and ostracized, isolated, and ultimately expelled from the academy? Only because he believed in it and he had the courage to say in what he believed? And what if he remained obstinate in his conviction? His voice is personal, solitary, so what? Is it so bad to be a minority of one? So how can we, the students of Rabbi Eliezer, how can the followers of Rabbi Eliezer not be moved by Rabbi Eliezer's destiny? Now, really, let's see in depth what the whole story is here to trouble us. Firstly, the Jews love to argue already then that we know. Read the Bible. Think of poor Moses. I always believe that he is one of the most tragic figures in the Bible. He was never happy. Either he had problems with God or troubles with the people. And he was always alone. Furthermore, that their debates were passionate and stormy and endless. Great. But what is more amazing, that they didn't argue over the quality of the oven, but over its purity. And both sides were stubborn and never conceded defeat. But then we also learned that Rabbi Eliezer was even more unyielding than all his colleagues. He never gave in, not even after being outvoted, not even after being excommunicated. But then, we must say, on another level, the legend contains some disturbing questions about everybody. Let's start with Rabbi Eliezer himself. Why was he so stubborn? Didn't he know the law about the majority rule? If all the others decreed the oven to be impure, why didn't he join them? After all, they must have had some good arguments on their side as well. Furthermore, what was his purpose? What was he really up to when he really opposed them to the very end? In the midst of a logical, reasonable debate, he suddenly resorted to tricks, almost to magic. Surely his opponents were right in rejecting all these tricks as legal or scholarly proof. We fail to understand his behavior, nor do we understand heaven. Why did heaven interfere in a human debate? And why did it scold the revered sages for disagreeing with Rabbi Eliezer? What about the famous Talmudic principle of freedom of belief and freedom of speech? The sage's behavior too eludes our comprehension. It was the heavenly voice criticizing them for being unduly harsh with their illustrious colleague. There must be something to it. Heaven can be right sometimes. Why then do they torment poor Rabbi Eliezer? Is it precisely because he was always right? But then, if he was right with regard to all issues, why did majority go beyond the present debate and nullify all his previous decisions and decrees on the issue of purification? Granted, he was wrong this time about the oven, he still could have been right on all the other aspects of Jewish law, or on that issue too. Then why were they declared wrong in their totality? And worst of all, really, how is it possible that the great Rabbi Eliezer was excommunicated for that? Simply because he held views that differed from those of the academic or religious establishment? Now, what is the Talmud if not the art of listening? Tashema, come and listen, we say again and again and again in the Talmud. Come and listen. The main principle is come and listen. To listen means to try and understand the opponent's view. Always. To understand Talmud means study. To study Talmud is to study values and principles inherent in study. The illuminated horizons pushed back to study. But it also means to study the art of studying. A study implies memory, it implies also respect for the other. One studies in order to remember. One studies in order to know what to say to everybody, even those who disagree, especially to those who disagree with me. Without memory and without respect, study is futile. Aletheia in Greek means truth. And what is truth? Things one cannot forget. Some masters are more vivid than others, more imaginative too. Here and there we may meet one who is mentioned once or twice in the Mishnah, in the context of a vague halachic issue or an odd anecdote related to it. That does not mean that they were less important. All were significant. The Talmud is a mosaic. All of its components are essential to its fabric. The Bible commands us to study Torah day and night, and that applies to Talmud as well. Study is seen as a remedy to evil, just as prayer is a remedy for misfortune. With prayer we may move God to intervene in human affairs, but not in scholarly debates. There the scholar's word is mightier than heaven's. In matters of law, the prophet's decision has no impact. The master's judgment alone carries weight because they know and they remember. So in a way, we know now, in a way, one might view the unique masterwork that is the Talmud as an appeal to human and divine tolerance. The house of Shammai and Hillel, of Abaye and Rava, and Rav and Shmuel. There is mutual respect between majority and minority. And all views are recorded, all opinions transmitted. Legend and lore, jurisdiction and science, philosophy and history. All these domains exist in the Talmud and all receive fair and equal treatment. Akadah and halacha, legend and law go together. They do not seek to polarize Jewish experience. One is never sacrificed at the expense of the other. How strange that this masterwork of the Jewish tradition, this call to human generosity, met with such extreme hostility outside. The Bible was not burned. The Talmud was. The Bible was violated. But the Talmud was despised, hated, even assaulted. What was it in the Talmud that an antagonist, so many people through so many centuries, the antagonist was universal? And why was it resented by scholars and scientists who spoke with pride of their emancipation? A Talmudic mind, quote unquote, is to this day a bad word in many circles, not necessarily Gentiles. The Talmud, to me, is an adventure of words, words that were sent out some 10,000 weeks or months ago on a long journey, a journey we have followed everywhere. The interplay between people and words is what the Talmud is still about. What really did happen when the temple was destroyed and its worshippers exiled or killed? The very survival of our people was at stake. It was then that the old Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai decided that the road would be long and harsh and often unbearable. And then, therefore, we needed some remedy, some hidden resources on the road. The Talmud offered a refuge to the wanderer, a beacon to the dreamer, a dream to the hungry beggar in the quest of fate. I must open a parenthesis. Years and years ago, I got a telephone call from the Dalai Lama. And I, a student of Hinduism at that time, I loved mysticism, studied, I prepared a thesis on the art and the appeal of suffering in religion. And I went to India, stayed there a few months, learned, went to ashram. And to get a telephone call from the Dalai Lama, my God, I went to see him. And I said, what can I do for you? And he said, it was years ago, he said, look, I read, who had been a compliment, it was very nice, flattering, that he read some of my books. Even he may lie, it doesn't matter, you know. And then he said, look, I know one thing. Your people went out from its homeland into exile 2,000 years ago, and it's still here. My people just left its homeland, Tibet. And we know it's going to be a very long road. Teach us, how did you survive? Let the Jewish people teach us the art of survival. And one of the things I spoke to him was the glory and the beauty and the sustaining power of our passion for study. When we left, we didn't take with us from Jerusalem the gold or the silver or the money. We took a little book, just a little book, and that little book kept us alive. It kept our memory alive, our spirit alive. So here we come back to Rabbi Eliezer, who helped us. Who was Rabbi Eliezer, son of Hyrcanus? Not too much is known about his early childhood, a little bit here and there. Only one story or one type of story illustrates his ignorance. And this also tells us about his thirst for knowledge and for being a bachelor. Being the son of a well-to-do father, he could afford to stay away from books and did for a while. Most sources mention his 22nd or 28th year as the turning point in his life, when he chose to leave home and join a study group. Until then, he was practically illiterate. Like his brothers, he helped his father in the fields. But he was not happy, and he showed it. He could not work without shedding tears. He was crying all the time. Why are you crying? His father was asking. Is it because you are plowing here and you would rather go there? Then go there. Still, Eliezer kept on crying. Again, Hyrcanus wanted to know why. Finally, his son told him, I want to go and study. Hyrcanus was flabbergasted. "Study," he exclaimed, "you how? At 22? Go and marry a nice Jewish girl. Have children. And let them study." And from this episode already we learn much about the character of both the father and the son. Evidently, Hyrcanus was as good a father as he was an efficient employer. While he did not wish his sons to be spent on vague academic careers, he refused to let them become idle playboys. They had to work. The son obviously was shy and timorous. Otherwise, he would not have waited so long to explore the charms and complexities of both Torah and married life. That he did when he waited until the age of 22 to start his formal education. It seems to me that this one is less astonishing than the fact that he still was a bachelor at that time. 23 then was already a very old age. But don't feel sorry or worry for him, not yet. He eventually ran away from home, became famous, and married Ima Shalom, the sister of the president. Now, how did it all happen? One day, Eliezer, penniless and hungry, came to the school of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He sat down in tears. "Why are you crying?" asked the old master. "Oh, because, said the youth student, "because I want to study Torah." "Have you ever learned anything before?" "No," said Eliezer. So the revered master began teaching him the Shema Yisrael, "Hear, O Israel," and two laws a day. What the teacher did not know was that his pupil had nothing to eat. Legend has it that he fed himself with earth until he exhaled bad odors, and they became so bad that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sent his other students to investigate the matter, and they reported back to him, "Eliezer has not eaten for over 8 days. "Eliezer, Eliezer," commented the old sage, "just as I smelled your bad breath, the whole world will smell the fresh breath of Torah from your mouth." And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gave him a fellowship that paid for his food and lodging. Boston University is not the first to do that. Eliezer stayed with him 3 years and became a success. Thanks to his prodigious memory, he rapidly skipped from one level of knowledge to the next and mastered them all until he was accepted in the immediate entourage of the teacher, who favored him over many others. In the meantime, back at the ranch, Hyrcanus had made some bad business deals. He lost all his money, but made some more gains all over again. The economic situation was never wonderful in Palestine, and now Eliezer's brothers incited their father to disown him because he ran away from home. "Look at Eliezer," they said. "While you were in trouble, he abandoned you and went to Jerusalem." Hyrcanus thought that their argument had merit and said, "All right, I shall go to Jerusalem and declare publicly that Eliezer will not receive anything from what I possess." And this he did. He came to Jerusalem either on a Shabbat or on a holiday, just as many dignitaries were gathering to celebrate with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. We even have the VIP guest list: Ben Tzitzit Hakas Keset, Nagdimon Ben-Gurion, and Kalba Savua, all three prominent merchants, as well as other leaders of the community. Hyrcanus was seated next to them, in the first row, in the very best position to observe the stage. Suddenly, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the old teacher, turned to Eliezer and invited him to speak in his place. Eliezer humbly refused. "All I know," he said, "is what I received from you. How could I give you anyone or anyone else anything?" But the old master insisted, as did the other students. And so Eliezer had to submit. It was his first public appearance. It seems he was in ecstasy and that he said things no one had ever heard before. A singular light emanated from his face and from his entire being. All those present forgot where they were, and whether it was the day or it was night. They even forgot who they were. Commented Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, "Happy are you, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that you are their descendant." And he kissed Eliezer on his forehead. "Who is this young scholar?" asked Hyrcanus, and they told him. "What?" he exclaimed. "Is that why I came? And now I am so happy to be that he is my son." And he went on, "I want you all to know that I came here with one idea, to disown my son Eliezer. And now I have decided that he will inherit all my possessions." But Rabbi Eliezer refused, saying, "I never asked for wealth or any earthly possessions. All I sought to acquire was Torah, the knowledge of Torah." And the Midrash Tanhuma offers a different version of his initiation to study. Here too, Hyrcanus is rich. He has all kinds of business dealings with all kinds of people which provoke the Roman occupants. They seem to arrest him, and they came to arrest him. And he flees to do his children with all that he wanted to do, to give them everything with one exception. Instead of going into hiding, Eliezer went to Jerusalem. And there he joined the school of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. In the meantime, Hyrcanus managed to settle his problems with authorities. He is again a wealthy man, but then he begins having troubles at home. His sons incite him to disown their missing brother Eliezer. "When you needed him," they said, "he was not with you. Now he will come back and claim his share in the inheritance." "Don't worry," Hyrcanus replied. "I shall disinherit him in writing." "In writing?" they exclaimed. "Great. Because Eliezer will say that the document is false. Furthermore, should we turn to the courts, there is in Jerusalem one teacher, Yochanan ben Zakkai. He will surely favor him over me." "Really," said Hyrcanus, "then I shall go to Jerusalem myself and declare publicly my decision," which he did. But then he heard his son's lecture and he changed his mind. And since then, you should learn to lecture. That thus everything is actually the same except for the middle. Eliezer, in both stories, begins as an ignorant and ends as a scholar. In Tanhuma, he does not cry all the time, which is, by the way, more in character with him and more in my liking. Another difference. In the first version, he lectures on mysticism. In the next, the second, the topic is more real. He comments on a passage in Scripture, Vayehi Mei Amraphel, which describes the first war in the Bible and the first punishment for provoking it. Harbam tavo belibam, those who make war will perish by war, he said. The pacifist address, yes and no. Eliezer, the militant disciple of Shammai, was a pacifist on his terms. He spoke against Rome's war policies, not against the Jewish resistance to them. What he said to the occupant was, "You came to conquer us, you will be defeated. It may take years, perhaps centuries, but our land will be free again, Jewish again. For us, we do not believe in conquest. We are saying it to this very day, and I believe in it. We lost our land to Roman conquest, a conquest we never recognized as valid. And I don't believe that it's in our Jewish character to be conquerors." We remained faithful to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai to the end, so did he. When the old master decided to be smuggled out of besieged Jerusalem in a coffin, Rabbi Eliezer was one of the two disciples who carried him through the gates. The other one was his colleague, Rabbi Yoshua. Together with his teacher and his fellow students, he witnessed the siege of the city in hunger. the national humiliation, the destruction of the temple. He saw foxes roaming in the ruins of the sanctuary. He lived the end of an era, the end of Jewish political independence. After the death of their master, Rabbi Eliezer and his friends gave new impetus to the Academy of Yavne. The school was called Keren Yavne, the Vineyard of Yavne. Why the vineyard? Because of his students who listened to the debate sitting in rows upon rows, lined up like the vines in a vineyard. They were all convinced that study and study alone could give the Jewish people and save it from extinction. Theirs was a passionate yearning for study and knowledge which linked them to ancient memories and inserted their present into a context of eternity. Every word from every master was valid only if it was transmitted in the name of their masters. No plagiarism was allowed. Every opinion, every legend had to be part of the tradition going back to Sinai. Thus, in hearing Rabbi Eliezer or Rabbi Akiba, a student could capture the echo of Sinai and therefore could hand them down further and further to every new generation of students and teachers. And strange as it may sound, they could do this without relative impunity. The Romans seemed not to mind Jewish study. It was Jewish politics at that time they considered dangerous. When you study all that, the history of that learning, what was an academy? The academy really was teachers and their students. And the most important thing, every academy had actually a scribe, an archivist. That was one of the teachers who remembered everything. Usually that teacher who was chosen for that purpose was not very intelligent. If he was intelligent, he was disqualified. Because we didn't want the transmitter to have his own opinions. But we wanted his memory to remember who said what, around what subject, when. Not him. We don't want to hear him. We want to hear the teachers speaking through him. And so, from generation to generation, the Torah, the study of Torah, was transmitted. And miraculously, it was always there. All the conflicts, all the digressions, all the anecdotes, and all the laws were there. A brief glimpse of the overall situation might be useful. We are at the end of the first century. The temple has been destroyed for some years. The Lion of Judah defeated. Rome can jubilate and stop worrying. After all, its political victory seems total and irrevocable. How long can the occupant's fury last? Well, a long time. Though with some breaks, the sanctuary has been razed and its site plowed with the sole purpose of humiliating the Jews. Rabban Gamliel, the president of the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, has been sentenced to death, but the decree is abolished. The times are turbulent. The Roman mood changes from week to week, from emperor to emperor. Titus succeeds Aspasianus and is in turn succeeded by Domitianus. Who is better? Titus is the most cruel as far as Jews are concerned. But in Rome, according to Deus Cassius, he fares better. The people see in him a more tolerant and human ruler. A presidential delegation composed by Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hanania, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkanos goes to Rome to intercede on behalf of Palestinian Jewry. And while they represent no government, no army, no prestigious group, they do express the fears and hopes of Israel, and therefore they embody the dignity of Israel. They are not only emissaries of a defeated nation, but of an eternal people, vanquished, yet invincible. In Rome, the delegates discover with astonishment that there are in the city Jewish children, knowledgeable in Jewish law, and lore, and there the Jewish community does exist still.
The visitors are impressed and encouraged. Still, their mission ends in failure. Rome's attitude deteriorates. Its repressive policies become increasingly harsh. The new emperor, Domitianus, is even more bloodthirsty than his predecessors. His goal is simply to exterminate all Jews everywhere, and his reasons are religious as well as political. Yavne is now threatened. The Sanhedrin, famous Sanhedrin, defers many of its meetings and transfers them elsewhere. It has become too dangerous to summon its 71 members from all over the country. Consequently, a kind of executive committee takes over and handles the most urgent affairs. Its members, Rabban Gamliel, the president, Old W. Shua ben Hananya and Rabbi Eliezer, the two friends who shared so many memories from missions in Rome. And there are people going everywhere. Some of them are beleaguered. Some escort the sickly Rabbi Tzadok, who had fasted so many years for the sake of Jerusalem that his emaciated body had become transparent. And now the two comrades abruptly split. Who, Rabbi Eliezer's chief opponent during the famous clash with the majority about Achnai's oven, who is the one who ordered the river and the tree and the walls to disobey him? Rabbi Yeshua, son of Hananiah, Rabbi Eliezer's best friend. He is the one actually who leads the campaign against Rabbi Eliezer. But what had happened between them? To them? What happened to their friendship? This is what hurts me so much. I believe in friendship more than anything I can believe in. And was it Rabbi Eliezer's character that aroused antagonism, even among those who loved him, and now became his adversary, his opponent? Well, let's see again. What kind of a good son was he? We know he was a good son. He honored and respected his father. But he said, if you wish to know the real meaning of the commandment, honor thy father and thy mother, said Rabbi Eliezer to his disciples, listen to the story of a Gentile named Dama, son of Metina. His mother was insane and would insult and strike him in the presence of his companions, but he never complained. All this Netanya would say was, enough, dear mother, enough. Once the most prestigious stone of the high priest's garment was lost. He, the Gentile, Dama, had one like it. So the priests went to him and offered him a large sum of money. He took it and went into the adjoining room to fetch the jewel. But then he found there his father asleep, his foot resting on the chest where he had hidden the jewel. He left the room noiselessly and told the priests that he must forget the large profit, for nothing on earth would he disturb his father in his sleep. The case being urgent, the priests, thinking that he was bargaining for a higher price, offered him more money. Again, he refused to disturb his father. So they waited until Netanya awoke. Only then did Dama go and fetch the jewel. And the priest handed him the last sum mentioned, a huge sum, but he refused to take it. And he said, I will not barter for gold the satisfaction of having done my duty as a son. Give me what you offered me for the first time, and he shall be satisfied. Also, he was a good brother. He forgave their intrigues and shared his inheritance with them. As a father himself later, he was more righteous. His son, also called Hyrcanus, refused to study. As a result, Rabbi Eliezer disowned him, and having learned from experience, assigned his entire fortune, not to his other children, but to heaven. At school, he was an extraordinary teacher. Rabbi Akiva's favorite. He was sometimes stubborn, which is both virtues and shortcoming, but he didn't like women too much. It bothers me. which surely it's not virtuous to dislike women. But he expressed opinion on women the way which I find unflattering. He says, for instance, whoever teaches his daughter Torah is like indulging in futility. No, really. He once explained why. He said a woman's wisdom lies in her manual work, you know, in the kitchen, not in books. He went even further and said, rather than giving divrei Torah, words of Torah, to women, burn them. I mean the words, not the women. Why was he so harsh with them? Because of his mother. We don't even know who she was, though probably she was a loving Jewish mother, unassuming and self-effacing. In fact, so selfless that she chose to stay outside the Talmud. No mention is made of her in any Talmudic treatises or Midrashic legends. But the Talmud does mention a woman, a famous one at that, which had an impact on him, his wife. Her name was Ima Shalom. And she was known not only because of her husband, but also because of her brother. She was President Rabban Gamliel's sister. Bright, sharp, temperamental. She was also the domineering type. Aware of her own importance, she took part in debates, both scholarly and domestic. Ima Shalom was such a liberated woman that on occasion she discussed in public her intimate, I would say her very intimate relations with her husband. When her brother prevailed upon most sages to excommunicate her husband, she surely must have been torn in her loyalties. But after that, said the Talmud, she did not allow Eliezer to say a certain prayer. She was afraid he might do harm to her brother. She watched him continuously, tirelessly. But one day a beggar came to the door asking for bread. She left her husband and went to fetch the beggar a piece of bread. When she returned, she found Rabbi Eliezer on his knees, sneaking in the prayer, deep prayer. Stop, she yelled. Do not kill my brother. Too late. At that moment, the sound of the shofar was heard from the official residence of Rabban Gamliel announcing the tragic news to the country at large. The president has died. How did you know when I didn't? Rabbi Eliezer asked his wife. And she said, I heard it from my father and he heard it from his father. Even when all the gates are closed, one remains open for the victims of injustice. Ima Shalom knew that God would eventually listen to her husband, who was a victim. He did not know. He never thought his words could hurt anyone. He believed in the supernatural, yes, we saw it, but never used it against others. One of his students once taught in his presence, poor wife, Rabbi Eliezer commented to Ima Shalom, she will soon be a widow. And it came to pass, the student died. How did you know, she asked her husband. I did not, said Rabbi Eliezer. All I knew was that whoever teaches in the presence of his teacher deserves to die for his impudence. In other words, Rabbi Eliezer did not want it to happen, but he knew that it would. A man of such knowledge and temper keeps people away, and he must have inspired fear. It was too dangerous to risk displeasing or annoying him. Once he lectured all day on laws related to holidays. Was he not exciting enough? Probably. For as he spoke, he noticed a group of listeners who got up and left. Well, he said, they probably have big barrels of wine at home and are in a hurry to empty them. After a while, a second group left. Oh, they have smaller barrels, said the lecturer, but they are thirsty. After a while, a third group left. Well, said Rabbi Eliezer, they have no barrels. They only have bottles, some bottles, but they do need a drink. After the sixth group had left, he muttered, they have nothing, and yet they are living. Aleph Aleph Halevi, writer, found a similar story in ancient Greek sources, told by Strabon after a certain singer who came to give a concert on an island where the inhabitants were hungrier for fish than for music. I quote, "He sang and played beautifully, and everybody was there listening attentively until they heard the ringing of the bell announcing that the fish merchant had arrived, and they all rose to their feet and ran to the fish market. The performer was left with one man alone. 'Oh, I am grateful to you,' said the singer, 'for the honor you have paid me, and above all, for your love of music. For unlike all the others, you stayed with me, whereas they ran away as soon as they heard the bell.' 'What? The bell?' said the man. 'You said they rang the bell? Then I must hurry.' He was no music lover. He was simply deaf. A more modern version of that was told to me by a dear friend. The great pianist Yasha Heifetz came to give a concert somewhere in a forsaken village. But the conditions were disastrous. Stormy winds and snow and icy roads kept everybody indoors except for an old couple. They sat patiently in the empty auditorium, waiting for the great violinist to appear. He was moved by their passion for his art. 'How could I ever express my gratitude for you?' he asked them. And they said, 'Oh, we do not want you to give us the entire program. Sing for us for 5 minutes.' As for Rabbi Eliezer, he was angry when his audience deserted him. 'Feel sorry for them,' he remarked. 'They are leaving eternal life for pleasures that last only 1 hour.'" A true follower of Shammai, he discouraged proselytes from converting to Judaism. He had no patience with them and their problems. Once a woman asked him to convert her, "Tell me about yourself," he said. "Who are you? What have you done?" And she was brief. In Hebrew, those who know Hebrew must understand it better. I'll translate right away. She said, "Only one thing. Beni hakatan mi beni hagadol." Which means, "My youngest son is the son of my oldest son." If ever you want a story about incest, that's the story. Now, he actually didn't like that. So she was not his student. But he did attract the famous Achilles and showed him respect and affection. His attitude was of either or. Yakov Hadin et Hahar. The law must pierce mountains. If Israel resents, he said, the Messiah will come. If Israel repents. And what if they don't? Asked his friendly opponent, Rabbi Yeshua. The redemption will not come, said Rabbi Eliezer. Not so, answered Rabbi Yeshua. If the Jewish people does not repent, God will send a cruel king who with his harsh decrees will move them to penitence and repentance. For Rabbi Eliezer, half measures are not valid. Repentance must be a personal act, not a response to outside pressure. He was critical of Job for having criticized God, whereas Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananiah believed Job only criticized Satan. His approach to scripture is almost literal. The dead were resurrected in the book of Ezekiel and then came back to life, according to his outlook. Moreover, they stood on their feet and sang their praise to God, but then they died again. When he was ill and on the threshold of death, he was visited by scholars. "Why did you come?" he snapped at them. "What do you want?" "We want to learn from you," they said, "from a distance, because if one is excommunicated, one cannot be approached by anyone." "You want to learn?" he asked. "Then why did you wait so long?" "Oh, because," they said, "we had no time." He looked at them and said, "I wonder whether you will die a natural death. What about me? Asked his illustrious disciple Rabbi Akiva. You said, Rabbi Eliezer, harshly, your death will be more cruel than theirs. They had not told him the truth. That is why he was angry. The truth was that they avoided him for the simple reason that they did not dare violate the ban against him. True, students still flocked to him and to his academy in Lida, but it was no longer the same. The older and renowned ones stayed away, which brings us back to the question, why was he excommunicated in the first place? Only because he disagreed? Surely there must have been some other problems. Well, we know at least one. He seems to have entertained illicit relations with members of a new sect. Christians, they were called then, the Minim, who in those early years were persecuted by the Romans even more than the Jews were. Rabbi Eliezer occasionally discussed the interpretation of Torah with a disciple of Jesus named Yaakov from the village of Ksania. Arrested and tortured by Romans for allegedly being a sympathizer of the dissidents, Rabbi Eliezer was pardoned by the Roman governor only when the old Jewish sages came to plead for him. Well, we are almost at the end of the story, or at least, but one thing we still remember. When he, Rabbi Eliezer, is interrogated by the Roman governor about his possible heresy, he, the sage, the stern follower of Shammai, chooses ambiguity. The only time that he is ambiguous. Why didn't he deny the charges? Why didn't he say what his disciple Rabbi Akiva would have said? I am a Jew. I believe in the God of Israel and in him alone. Kill me if you wish, but you shall not kill my love for God. Our teacher and master, Professor Shaul Lieberman of blessed memory, offered a moving explanation. Had Rabbi Eliezer answered any question, sooner or later he would have been drawn in a long exchange, and finally he would have been compelled to touch on his excommunication by his own friends and companions. And this he refused to do. We never have heard him say anything, any protest against what I believe to be an unfair, unjust act of excommunication. He saw that as an internal Jewish affair of no concern to the occupant. Thus he chose then a kind of Fifth Amendment. Now, we have also to say, incidentally, that the only place in the Talmud where the New Testament is quoted is in the story related to him, Rabbi Eliezer, or rather to his wife, Ima Shalom. One of her neighbors was a judge with a strong reputation for open-mindedness, or rather open-handedness. He could be bought. Once he had before him a case relating to an inheritance to be divided between brothers and a sister. He issued one ruling, then reversed himself, quoting first Scripture, then the New Testament, then Scripture again, depending on whose bribe was the more important. One side gave him a candelabra, the other countered with an expensive donkey, and the donkey with a case. The donkey won the case. Commented Ima Shalom's brother Rabban Gamliel, between a donkey and a candle, the donkey is stronger, for after all, he can extinguish the candle. Obviously, this judge, as we say sometimes, was the best money could buy. Though a man of unbending principles, Rabbi Eliezer was forgiving in his personal relations with people. He always showed great understanding and compassion, caring for his fellow man more than for himself, protecting someone else's honor as much as his own. Immune to envy or jealousy, he demanded everything from himself and little from anyone else. And when his master asked him what is the most important virtue man would seek, his answer was a good eye, which means to see everything good in the other, always. Not to condemn anyone unduly, not to downgrade human beings, not to humiliate anyone, not to ridicule anyone. His love for the Jewish people was boundless. Then he loved people in general. Well, Rabbi Eliezer, the great one that we love so much, we know then what his life was at the end, because he was then still excommunicated. And the laws of excommunication are very harsh. They hurt. But they were meant to hurt. So let us look therefore at the situation again. Rabbi Eliezer was a scholar of unparalleled erudition. Why did he invoke God's opinion in discussion with his friends on the oven? That was his mistake. They were not arguing about mysticism or poetry or even Agadah. They were arguing over the point of law, for they needed both sides lawyers, arguing legally over that point. Other sages disagreed with him. That was their privilege. He should have reasoned with them, drawing on his knowledge and experience. He should have used filibuster tactics to prevail upon them. Nobody would have stopped him. He should have trying to seek new evidence from different sources, formulating new interpretations, hoping to convince his old friend Rabbi Yeshua, and then another, and another. Isn't that what the Talmud is all about? Had the Tanaim relied on heavenly decrees, there would have been no room for debates or study or teaching or any communal life. In short, there would have been no Talmud to begin with. Thus had Rabbi Eliezer chosen to use his human qualities to convince his friends, he would have remained their friend and their teacher, even though he still would have remained a minority of one. His mistake was to call upon heaven rather than on logic. And he shouldn't have done that. Talmudic debates, as all debates, are and must be rational, logical. They must take place on the human level. Once you introduce a supernatural element, it dominates the discussion and in effect eliminates the participants. Such an attitude is dangerous. Now we understand why Rabbi Eliezer's friends reacted as violently as they did. They were angry not with his views, although they disagreed with them, but with his methods. What did Rabbi Yeshua say in his outburst? Lo bashamayim hi, Torah is not in heaven. In other words, once God gave us the Torah, let us consult the Torah, not God. The Torah is his, but its interpretation belongs to us. Meaning, yes, the Torah does not change, but its interpretation does. Also, God does not change, but he is in change. For he is in every man, whatever he or she does. Rabbi Eliezer believes that the Torah is above time, whereas his colleagues maintain that it is linked to all times. True, the Torah is eternal and timeless, but that does not mean that it is above time, above the present. It only means that it constitutes the eternal dimension of the present. And thus we now realize that the argument over the oven of Achnai reflects a basic, even essential outlook over crucial issues. The place of Torah and the possible limits of interpretations. Consequently, the sages were right in telling Rabbi Eliezer, since you do not speak the same language that we do, there is no point in continuing the debate. The whole argument is futile, since one does not argue with God especially not in matters of law. And so the sages were right. And now we understand the rest of the story, which in conclusion we feel we must now relate and explore. The sad debate was over, and the participants dispersed. Rabbi Nathan, another sage, went for a walk in the fields and stumbled upon his favorite source of information, Prophet Elijah. "Tell me," said Rabbi Nathan, "what did God do while we were arguing?" And the prophet smiled, saying, "God? God smiled. He was amused." "What? God was amused?" "Yes. You know what? He may even have laughed," said the prophet. "For God's command was, Nitzchuni Banai, look," he said, "my children have defeated me." Yet God took it personally. "Me," he said, "they defeated me, not Rabbi Eliezer, but me, since I was on his side and I was the authority he invoked." And this exchange offers two lessons. One, God does not always win. Two, when his children do, he does not lose. He loses only when they do something to and against their fellow men. The term defeat, Nitzchuni, applies to the decision to excommunicate Rabbi Eliezer. Had they simply overruled his objections, had they declared his position illegal, God would have smiled with pride and joy. But they felt they had to set an example, and therefore the ban against him. And therefore God spoke of his own defeat. When one of his children is humiliated, God is defeated. And yet God was amused. And so his spokesman and defender said, "Rabbi Eliezer was angry, and he had every right to be. Not only did they decide to ban him, but they did so in his absence. Were they afraid of him? Were they embarrassed? The fact is that he was not present when the vote was taken, when the move was proposed and adopted. Who will go and inform him?" they asked one another. "I will," said Rabbi Akiba. He felt he would be able to handle the delicate mission, and he said so. "Someone else may be unworthy and say the wrong thing and thus cause Rabbi Eliezer to destroy in his anger, in his humiliation, the whole universe." And so Rabbi Akiba, the loving and faithful disciple, dressed himself in black and went to see his master, but did not come close to him, for one is not allowed to approach an excommunicated person. "Akiba, Akiba, what is the matter with you today?" wondered Rabbi Eliezer. And Rabbi Akiba said, "It seems to me that your colleagues have separated themselves from you." Look how delicate. "Not I, your colleagues, from you." Rabbi Eliezer understood. He tore his clothes and removed his shoes in mourning and sat down on the ground. Tears were flowing from his eyes. So great was his distress that nature itself was affected. All around him, the grain went bad and the dough turned sour. Legend has it that whatever fell under his gaze caught fire. Rabbi Gamliel happened to be on a boat. A storm threatened to break it and make it sink with all its passengers. This must be related to what we did to Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, taught the president. And he said to God, "Master of the universe, you know as I do that whatever I have done was not for my sake, nor for the sake of my ancestors. I have done it only for your sake, your glory, in order to avoid conflicts within Israel." And the storm abated. And now all is clear. The sages sought to avoid conflicts, disputes, fragmentation. They were not against minority views, nor were they against different opinions. They were against fanatic opinions. And none is as fanatic as the one that claims to derive from heaven. Such attitudes inevitably provoke splits, and in those critical times, with the temple ruins still in everyone's memory, the Jewish people needed unity of purpose and an awareness of man's duty and power in order to be able, literally, to be able to dream of renewed glory and sovereignty. And now, as we are about to take leave of Rabbi Eliezer and his friends, we must stress the point that within the framework of Talmudic memory, they have become friends once more. The Jerusalem Talmud emphasizes that as long as Rabbi Eliezer was alive, Rabbi Yeshua ruled against him. But after his death, the same Rabbi Yeshua reversed himself and ruled in Rabbi Eliezer's favor. So therefore we know, we remember that the relative injustice done to Rabbi Eliezer, they tried to correct it. The key to his teaching was not innovation, but recreation, which means memory. Listen to the way he described his own approach to tradition, which means transmission. He said, look at the teacher at him. What was he proud of? If all the oceans, I quote him, if all the oceans were to become ink and all the trees pens and heaven and earth parchments and all men and women scribes, they still would not be able to write down what I learned from my teachers. Such affection, such love, and such respect for one's teachers are rare among men, even among sages, and they alone justified his being called Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol, the great Rabbi Eliezer. Was God among his teachers? Possibly. But what is more amazing and more beautiful is perhaps then, and sometimes to others, God was Rabbi Eliezer's student.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the second of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled In the Talmud, The Greatness of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. Professor Wiesel was introduced by Boston University Department of Religion Chair Deanna Klepper. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.